Go Queen Linda.
Hambone, hambone, where you been? Round the corner and back again. Mm-hmm. Hambone, hambone, where you was? Oh, yeah. In the kitchen cooking rice. Hambone.
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 Give me hambone. Hambone. Give me some hambone.
Hambone.
Well, now, hambone, hambone, put him on your shoulder. Mm-hmm. If you get a pretty girl, I'll show you how to hold her. Mm-hmm. Hambone, hambone, where you been? All around the world and back again. Hambone.
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 Crazy
hambone.
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 Hambone. Hambone. Hambone. Hambone. Hambone.
Queen Linda talking about the ham bone. Mm-hmm. Said now ham bone, what you gonna do? Got in a train and a fella flew.
Come
said ham bone, where did you go?
Yeah.
To Miss Lucy, I'll tell the story now. Miss Lucy, would you marry me? Well, I don't care if Papa don't care. Ham bone, oh
ham bone,
ham bone, 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 bone,
bone,
bone, bone, bone, bone, bone, bone.
Bubba
to the bone,
to
I take a, take a, I say,
boom, 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 boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that's Amakayla, Being in Love is the CD, and Hambone is the song. And we are going to be devoting the whole show to films you have not seen yet, films that are sort of being featured and also opening here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're going to be talking to one of the programmers at the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival, which is having its 13th annual, my goodness, 13 years, wow, program this opening June 5th and continuing through the 19th throughout the Bay Area in multiple venues. And so while we wait for our programmer, Jennifer, to join us, and then she's going to be followed by conversations with the directors of First Friday, Bronx Obama, True Son, and then we're going to have a pre-recorded interview with the director of Test, which is opening on the 6th in Bay Area theaters. So here's the rest of Hambone.
With my beef, hambone, the hambone, the hambone.
That was Hambone. Well, yesterday was the elections here in the San Francisco Bay Area in California. And, wow, I was amazed at the low turnout. So it's really great that we're going to be speaking to a couple of directors about their films actually are thematically about elections and people taking charge and changing things. True Son specifically, which looks at the election of Michael to the city council there in Stockton. I guess it maybe is about 3 years ago now. No, 2 years ago now. And then Bronx Obama looks at the protagonist who has a striking resemblance for the president. And then First Friday actually sort of addresses people's rights to live in harmony in the streets and have fun and enjoy art and art's transformative power of sort of bringing community together and looking at that First Fridays in Oakland and what happened when a young person was killed. So, I'm stalling. Wanted to let people know that our dear friend Yuri Koshiyama made her transition this past Sunday, June 1st. Wonderful woman, revolutionary, supporter of the political prisoners and prisoners of war, and a dear friend of Ilhaj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. If you remember Malcolm X's story, when he was shot and killed in the Audubon Ballroom, he wasn't alone because Yuri was there. She held him as he made his ascension in that really dreadful moment when his life was taken away at 39 years old. So we're going to continue with Amikayla, since she happens to be right where I am cued into the studio. And I'm going to see if maybe we can get some of our directors in the studio early, since Jennifer is not joining us right at the moment. She might have gotten busy, you know, preparing for things to get started. So here's Dreamer.
My sad little dreams to the soft evening.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Oh, no. Let's see. All righty. I am wondering what's going on here. My guests are all calling in kind of late. So we will play Angela Wellman's Back on Track, and hopefully we won't get to the end of that because it's a long piece. Oh, I think that's our guest. Good morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks.
Thank you.
Oh, who's joining me?
This is Nigeria Eaton.
Oh, Nigeria, good. Nice to hear from you, because this morning, for some reason, my guests are not calling in, so it's like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, no.
I was hoping I wouldn't have to play another long song. Yeah, love your film. I guess your director's going to be calling in separately, right?
Yes, she's calling in separately.
Okay, excellent. Well, your film, First Friday, is just so beautiful. I just love the poetry. Did you
Thank
write
you.
That? Who wrote the wonderful poem that sort of weaves itself through the work? So lovely.
Thank you. Yeah. That was a funny idea that the director had, Mario Ferloni. He had this great idea to have kind of a subjective lyrical narrator, sort of like the films of Terrence Malick, and we were looking for the right voice, and a friend of mine recommended this woman named Michelle Lee, who is a wonderful writer, poet, teaching artist with You Speaks, and who I've seen perform live like 8 years ago in Oakland, and she goes by the name Mush, and so he said Mush. I was like, yes, Mush is brilliant, because she's just... she's a fantastic writer. She has such a lovely voice. She lives in Fruitvale and just, grew up. Her parents owned a restaurant in Oakland, so she was just the right voice to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just beautiful. And then the cinematography just really captures, you know, all of what is so lovely about this city here in the East Bay. Just really great. And I was just wondering sort of, you know, how you all just sort of chose the characters that you were going to follow and the scenes you were going to shoot. Maybe you could we start at the beginning and maybe tell our audience about First Friday. What is that phenomena, First Friday?
Yeah, so it's it's been going on for a while now, and it started off just as several local galleries decided to coordinate their openings, and then started off as like maybe blocking off one street, and then over years it just grew to when it was at its peak, I think around like, January of 2013 and that, previous fall, it went from like the 27th Street, 27th and Telegraph in Oakland all the way up to 14th Street. So this long, sprawling event filled with artists and galleries and dancers, performers, and musicians, and bands, and vendors, and just filled with, every single kind of part of humanity that can possibly find in the Bay Area. And, my parents are from the D.C. area, and they came to visit, and they're just shocked. They're like, I've never seen people of so many races and different ages and backgrounds hanging out together with no issue before and just really connecting. And that's what was the really great beauty of First Friday, is that it's a space that allows everyone to be there, and usually without much conflict.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And the story starts with I believe your youngest protagonist, who is looking for his name, which I'm not finding right now. What is it?
Casey.
Casey, and we go to school with him. Like, where is he in school?
He was at Oakland High. He's entering his senior year. And for Casey, Casey is a foster kid, and that was his, I think, fifth high school in 4 years.
Oh, my.
And he's just a really extraordinary individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I saw some people actually in the film that I know, like Tomei.
Oh, great.
Gallery owner and artist, and then you have the city council person for District 3. She is really involved in First Friday. I mean, she's dancing and speaking, and the particular First Friday that you focus on is one that is kind of sad, and it's also changed sort of the nature of First Fridays for those mm-hmm. that have been, you know, there from the beginning, you know, when there were more galleries and the it was longer, like instead of four blocks, I believe it was, what, eight blocks?
Yeah.
Something like that? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it got shorter that month in response to the murder that happened the previous month in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And tell us about some of the other characters that you profile. When I read the synopsis before I saw it, I thought it was a feature. I didn't know that these people were that it was a documentary, but
mm-hmm.
Made like a feature in that,
yeah.
You know, these are real people, but the way that you did it so artfully, it feels like a feature film, but then, you know, like, because you recognize people, it's like, oh, this is,
mm-hmm. yeah.
this is a documentary.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's a huge compliment, I think, to both Mario, who is kind of the director who had the vision of what he wanted the film to look like, and our credible teams of cinematographers that shot to give it that look, this kind of this feature film. Our other characters, we knew we were making a film. We wanted to find people who are kind of play this archetype role. So we know we wanted someone who who represents the city. So that ended up being City Councilwoman Lynette McElhaney. We knew we wanted a youth to kind of show the perspective of, like, this is one of the few safe spaces for youth to go to at night, and that ended up being Casey. We knew we wanted to have a organizer, someone who helps to organize First Friday, because it was a time of pure volunteer organization where they worked, you know, dozens of hours a week free to organize this every month for people. And that organizer ended up being James Copes, who, you know, born and raised in Oakland, and she's a prominent figure in Oakland. And you know, his claim to fame is that he created the nickname Oaktown, and has been selling shirts and hats in Oakland since the 80s. We knew we wanted people who were perceived as gentrifiers, and so we found Dan and his wife, John, who lived at the time in a condo in Oakland, one of the condominiums that was developed by Jerry Brown's part of his 10K plan to, you know, persuade people who live in San Francisco to work in San Francisco to live in Oakland. We knew we wanted a longtime Oakland resident who lives along the path of First Friday, and that ended up being Pat Tanisha. So we knew the type of people we wanted to cast. And we lucked out in that we found people who were incredibly, like, compassionate and articulate and sympathetic, but also helped to complicate the archetypes. So, you know, I think outwardly people perceive Dan and Shauna as gentrifiers, but they also, like, have jobs that, like, you know, provide tremendous community benefits. So Dan works on public transportation for City of San Francisco, which makes, you know, people's lives like mine, commuting back and forth, much easier. And Sean works for a organization that provides small business loans to Oakland businesses. And, you know, one of the beneficiaries is New Parkway, which is, I attend, you know, as a visitor all the time. And so we just really lucked out in getting people who kind of complicate things and make us think differently about those archetypes. By the way, Mario Filoni is the director, and he's trying to call him. He says he's just getting a ringing, and
that
he's not able to dial in.
Oh, that's weird, because, is he dialing the right number? Because I don't, he should.
I think so.
Okay, tell him to try again.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Meg, why don't you talk about, because you have a really impressive biography. You know, you're a freelance producer, editor, youth media educator. Mm-hmm. Your short film, Perry County, in 2010, 30-minute screened at festivals around the country, is now being distributed by New Day Films. You were also the associate producer for The Waiting Room. We have the director on the show, and that's a phenomenal film. I went, I went to the screening at the Grand Lake and got a chance to meet many of the folks that were in the film. That was, wow, that was awesome. Yeah, and, sorry, go ahead. Oh, there he is. He's here. Ah, there's Mario.
Okay.
Yeah. Good morning, Mario. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Wanda?
I'm fine. Glad you were able to get into the studio because we certainly want to talk to you about this marvelous film that you and Jerry have made together. Let me read your bio a little bit and a little bit of your bio, and then maybe you could talk about, you know, your vision for the work. Mario Furlani, director, is a filmmaker and cinematographer based in Oakland. He studied documentary making at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, where he was a Carnegie Knight News 21 Fellow. His work has appeared on PBS and Time.com, among others. His first film, Pot Country, in 2011, 30 Minutes won Best Documentary at USA Short Film Festival in 2012, and it was official selection of Hot Docs in 2012 and Mill Valley Film Festival 2011, and a national finalist for the 2012 Student Academy Awards. Wow, I got a lot of circulation, huh?
Yeah, you did pretty well.
Excellent, yeah, and most recently you shot the short documentary After My Garden Grows. That was this year, 10 Minutes, by Academy Award winner Megan Mylan, which premiered at Sundance in 2014. So did you just get back from Sundance? Well, that just ended, right?
Yeah, it did. I actually didn't go. I had other things.
Yeah, like First Friday, right? Yeah, and so why don't you talk about First Friday? I was telling Jerry that it's just such a beautiful film, and the storylines are just, the way you weave them together is just gives one a real sense of place and a sense of Oakland, and the stories you capture are really representative of a lot of the different people that have been in Oakland and the people that are coming into Oakland, and then the sort of like, well, what do we want, like what is Oakland now and what do we want to see in Oakland? I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the film and your vision for it.
Sure. I mean, I think when Nidri first approached me with the idea, we talked about how to make a film that would sort of give a snapshot of what Oakland is like right now, you know, something that could be a document of this moment in time that could both serve to preserve this moment so that, you know, 20 years from now you can look back and be like, oh, this is what Oakland was like in 2013, 14, but also to show it to people here so that they can think, okay, what do we want this, you know, our community to be like in the future. And I think we very quickly decided on this idea that we needed many characters because we wanted to film in one day and have this very limited amount of time. We knew we wanted to have a cross-section of the city, and then Nidri and I worked a lot to get the right people, to follow the right people on that day. To find the people who were really representative of different parts of the city. And then we were lucky enough that they sort of met each other in different moments in the film and you could feel that they are in the same space and you know, that they're crossing paths, even if they don't necessarily talk, but that they are in this space where they can... and where they can actually intersect, and that is such a rare thing these days to have these public spaces where the mayor can intersect, you know, like is passing by as this kid from East Oakland is passing by and this protester is yelling at the mayor. You know, like, that kind of thing doesn't, there's not a lot of places like that anymore, I think, or maybe never were, but and the First Friday is one such place, and that's part of what drew us into the project.
I was thinking about, I was looking at some of my notes, and I was looking at sort of the whole idea of, you know, safety and, you know, First Friday's place that, you know, families could come and enjoy the music and food and art. And then when Keontae is killed, then that sort of interrupts that Oakland has had murders, but not at First Friday. And so for this young person to be killed, and then others, like when, you know, you have that sort of, I'm not sure exactly what the space was, but it was like a salon, and people were encouraged to talk to each other, and then they did a theater piece where they were sort of embodying what Oakland was to them in that particular moment. And one person had their hand up, and it was like a gun, their finger, a gun pointing at another person. And within, you know, the film, you know, you show that particular Friday after, First Friday after the young person, Keontae, was killed, there's an altar, and there's really beautiful display of candles, where people light candles for people that might have died, and then there's candles with other children and young people that have been killed in Oakland. And then the whole thing around having a moment of silence at the beginning of the First Friday, that particular Friday, a moment of silence at the end, and then the Occupy group coming through, not respecting that, and then the conversation around that. That was pretty interesting. Maybe you could talk about sort of that, you know, those, some of those moments that you capture that are really powerful in the film, like that one in particular.
Well, luckily, you know, this film came together really, really quickly. Like, we came up with the idea for the film, like, you know, a day after the shooting of Keontae. And then, you know, February's a short month, so we had really no time to get this film together. But luckily, we were able to partner with so many different organizations and people that helped us, so we weren't going in that day shooting completely blind. So we knew, like, with the candles, we knew that Oaklandish was going to convert their entire store into kind of a memorial. And we just looked out in the way that they did it so beautifully. But of course they did, because Oaklandish just has a really great aesthetic. But then it's still shocking to see how many of those place cards of people murdered were 18, 19, 20, 15, and that's just the reality of where we live in Oakland. We had been meeting the First Friday organizers, who meet every Wednesday. They have kind of subgroups, and one of the subgroups is focuses on youth and a youth block. And they knew that they wanted to do something to provide a space for youth and the adult community to talk about how to make and create spaces, safe spaces, how to reclaim space, and the issues of violence that's going on. And they did it at the New Parkway, which is where we filmed that. And you know, so you knew that was going on, but we didn't know this really beautiful moment was going to happen where, you know, these people, young and old, got together to show what does First Friday look like to them, in terms of, like, kind of their, you know, as fun as it is, and as it could also be dangerous, and we see them enact that. And so I think we just looked at that. We knew where things were going on, but, you know, the great thing about documentary film is that there's, even when you know things, there's still these wonderful little surprises, and I think that's why these moments end up, you know, can be so powerful. Mario?
No, I agree. I think you know, we plan, and then we try to be as near as many places as possible that night. And then planning who we are going to be with to capture moments, and And I think as far as that clash between the Occupy, the Epiphany March, and the moment of silence, I'm not sure that there was an intent from the march to disrupt the moment of silence per se. I'm not sure that they even knew that there was a moment of silence happening, but once they were there, there was, you know, it just, those two forms of protest clashed, even though I think politically most people were aligned there in some way to the, you know, but I think because this is a place that draws so many people, then it becomes also a center for the people who have something to say, and they need a place to say it, to come and sometimes disrupt it, you know. So.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on this wonderful film, First Friday. So tell me, when is it going to be screening? I know it's going to be screening on both sides of the bay, and, you know, as a part of the Documentary Film Festival. So where is it going to be screening first, and how many times is it going to be screening through this festival, which begins, I believe, tomorrow. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So, I just want to say thank you for having us on the show, and also want to say a big thanks to the SF DocFest and Chris Meltzer in particular, because they've been so helpful to us. These are actually going to be rough cut screenings, so the film's not quite finished yet, but we wanted to have the screenings to get feedback from the community, because we think that's really important as we kind of go towards this final push of finishing the film. Another thing that was really important for us is to have a screening both in Oakland and in San Francisco. So the Oakland screening is first, thankfully, and that is going to be on Saturday, June 14th, at the Oakland School of the Arts at 12:30 or 12 o'clock, Mario?
12:30.
And then we'll have another screening the next day in San Francisco at the Roxy at 2:30, that's Sunday.
So 12:30 at the Oakland School of the Arts on Saturday, June 14th, and then at the Roxy the next day at 2:30.
Okay, excellent. All right, super. Wow, well, we'll definitely want to have you on again to talk more about the film, particularly when you have your theatrical run.
Yeah, that would be great.
We would love to.
Yeah. And we could play some clips and let people sort of hear some things. But, of course, they're going to go and see the rough cut if they're in Oakland on June 14th at the Oakland School for the Arts. And if they're in San Francisco, then catch you at the Roxy on June 15th at 2:30. And maybe they might want to just catch you at both screenings because, you know it's going to be that fabulous of an experience because it's a wonderful film. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
You
bye
too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
Good. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I was so happy you called. I was like, hold on. I know you're there.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. What a wonderful film, Bronx Obama. Oh, my goodness. And it's your first feature, right?
It is, yeah.
What a great way to start with the president of the United States look-alike. Oh, my goodness.
I know, right? It's it was one of those stories that when I first met Louis, his name's Louis Ortiz, and he looks just like the president. And I just sort of knew immediately this was something I could make a feature out of. It just sort of, he's a fascinating guy, and all of the crazy situations he ends up in were fascinating and funny and dramatic, and the timing was right. I met him kind of in the middle of 2011, right before the 2012 election year, so I knew, oh, there's some amazing, context for what's about to happen. So I dropped everything and followed him around.
Yeah, you really did drop everything because this film was 3 years or so in your life.
Yeah, I followed him for about a year and a half, and not not 24 hours a day by any stretch, but, you know, to a lot of his gigs and when he was in the Bronx and when he was visiting family and that kind of thing. And then we spent another year and a half editing with some of my fabulous editors to get to a 90-minute feature we have here.
Yeah, yeah. But you were with him quite a bit because he's sleeping and you're there. I'm like, really?
I know, he said that to me as well. He said, really, you're going to film me sleeping on the couch here? but yeah, you know, I think from a filmmaking perspective, you know, the most interesting moments are kind of when nothing's happening. Of course, with Lewis, he goes out and people stop on the street and come up to him and have these crazy conversations and want his picture and all of that. But at the end of the day, he has to go home and kind of be Lewis again. And the film, in a lot of ways, kind of straddles that line of identity and trying to figure out, like, who you are when people see one thing and you go home and you're something else. I think that's a very complicated psychological state to be in, and it's mm-hmm. not something he ever asked for or wanted. It's just he happened to look like the guy who got elected president, mm-hmm. and so much so that it's hard for him to actually, you know, avoid it when he tries to.
Yeah, but it's really interesting that he never thought, I mean, he didn't even see the president in his face until someone said, you shave off the facial hair and then look in the mirror. And he'd had a career as with the phone company. He's a veteran, you know, good guy, single parent because his wife died. And, and then he loses his job like a lot of people do. And then all of a sudden this new role sort of opens up for him. He could be the Obama in the Bronx, like the one that people can, he says that they wouldn't, you know, say some of the things to the president that they would say to him, but, you know, when you know, people were like, when you show that the President Obama, his ratings have gone down in the polls. So mm-hmm. if you got somebody on the street that looks like the president and he dresses really nicely in his suits, and if you didn't know that the president's not walking around without, I mean, like, well, where's the Secret Service? I can't be the president, right?
well,
you know,
it's
they
funny,
could say
you know,
to you, sorry.
because the context matters a lot. I mean, when I'm there with a camera and it's, somebody stops to take a picture, then now there's a little crowd, and somebody else will, from far away, see the crowd, and then it sort of builds into this thing. But I think what's very interesting, you know, is that Obama's such a kind of man of the people. He tries to be, and certainly was elected in that with that image. But of course, he's, you know, the leader of the most powerful country in the world, so he's guarded by many layers of security and bureaucracy, and kind of he's in a position where he can't quite, you know, be among the people as much as he probably wants to. And so you have Lewis, who kind of, in the public's imagination, is like the Obama walking the street, president as one of the people, you know, and so when people see him, they kind of want to believe and they want to have that experience, even though rationally it's not what, it's obviously not true, but like emotionally it's like, oh my God, I here's my chance, you know. There was actually a video that the White House put out a couple weeks ago of Obama just taking a walk on the mall, on the National Mall, and, you know, of course, his whole security team's, like, chasing after him, but Obama just goes up to random strangers who happen to be in the park, and you can tell that the president is really enjoying it. He's like, oh, I don't get out of the White House that often.
Nice.
So I think he, the president, you know, kind of puts forward that image, and in some ways, Lewis gets to do it.
Yeah. It's really interesting. You know, first Lewis is acting as the president, and then, but you still see him in there, and then you know he's studying because he's a really intelligent man. And his daughter is she's really lovely, and she loves her dad, and she tells us that, you know, he was really brilliant. He skipped some grades, and you know he didn't get a chance to go to college, but you know he's being a really good example to her, and she's going to get her, you know, she says she's going to get her grades together and so she can go to college. And so, you know, when he starts, you know, doing the voice coaching and, you know, trying to get the nuances and the rhythm of President Obama's speech so that when you hear him, you know, that calls the president to mind. Then you sort of feel, you know, when he's on, he is the president, you know?
Yeah, I think the film really follows that transformation that Lewis undergoes. What I find fascinating is sort of where it gets really blurry. I mean, you see in the film there's scenes where he talks to his daughter as if he was the president, you know, and that's like, so you kind of have this blurring identity. You know, he's obviously not the president, but he's not really the old Lewis either. He's something kind of in between at this point. He's kind of the Barack Obama, you know.
Yeah. And so to tell you something about character and invention and sort of how we can shift the script, so to speak, because, you know, before when he was looking in the mirror at himself, you know, he just saw himself as a middle-aged, unemployed Puerto Rican father from the Bronx, right? And then, you know, when he shaves his face and, you know, changes the way he dresses and carries himself, it's like just that new, that just sort of breathes a different, I guess, possibility into his life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a chance to reinvent yourself, right? I mean, that's the American dream. That's the American dream by definition, is kind of that opportunity. But I think, you know, I think what is important to remember is that opportunity comes with costs. You know, it's nice to have that chance to make a better life, but you also have to not forget kind of the core of who you are. And I think that comes into tension in Lewis's story and in a lot of people's stories when they are chasing after something and have to kind of build a different, you know, a different image than their past life or for whatever reason. I think you run the risk of kind of becoming lost at sea in a way. And I think, you know, I think what I found really compelling about Lewis's story in a lot of ways is that it parallels some of the things we think about Obama and kind of how the American dream is working. And at the end of the day, in some ways, his daughter, Raina, is really the one who gets to, hopefully bear the fruit of the real American dream, to be the first one to go to college and kind of make a step up, do better than her parents did. I mean, that's what we're all hoping to do.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, though, Ryan, that in order to support himself and to support his daughter, that Lewis Ortiz can't be himself. He has to turn into a whole nother person. I mean, it's not just a job. He can't, like, step out of the character because when he's in character, it's like an advertisement for more jobs. Because he, at one point, he says, I have, what did he say, he has $70 or something like that? Because when he decides to take on this impersonation as like a career goal, he takes his investments and you know, puts it into the character and developing his profile. And if it didn't fly, then he would have really been in bad shape. And then you film his apartment. It's like his apartment is, like, not that great. You know, it looks like a one-bedroom and real tight at that. And, and he doesn't have to stay there because is that his family? Is it that his mother and father that are in Florida? Or is that his
So his parents are in Florida. And you know, he's in a small place in the Bronx and kind of getting by as best he can. And it's kind of almost just like a superhero suit, you know, when he's at home in his apartment, he's just kind of Lewis, and then he puts on the suit and walks out, and people hand him babies or whatever. I mean, we were at dinner at one of the film festivals, and the waiter was like, just have a discount on us, no problem, Mr. President, you know, like, so to be treated those two different ways, it's complicated.
Yeah, it sure is. So talk about your experience filming the Obama, Bronx Obama. How was this for you, filming, making, your first feature-length film as opposed to, the shorter film, and then the investment in time, and I'm sure you changed some too, right, in the process, and I know there were different versions of this film, in different media too, like radio. And
it's been an interesting process, I've grown a lot as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, because the first thing we did was a radio story for This American Life, and then I was already working on the feature film at that point, but we adapted it for the radio, and then we adapted a short for the New York Times right around election time, and then now the feature. So I've kind of told bits and pieces of the story in different ways. And I think we're kind of in this interesting time where all of the business models around media are in some ways sort of up for grabs. And they each have their own audiences, and they each have their own strengths in terms of how you tell a story. And so I've really learned a ton about how to approach a story depending on who you're telling it to, what kind of audience, how long people are going to spend with the story. I mean, it's one thing to click on a 5-minute video while you're supposed to be doing your work, and instead you're watching this little video on your work computer. It's a totally different thing to spend 90 minutes in a theater or on your couch dedicated to one story. So growth for me as a storyteller to try to understand what it takes to keep an audience engaged and laughing and emotionally engaged with what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also because you have such a great subject, the president, of course, he's always topical, even when he's no longer president. But Luis Ortiz, he is quite interesting. I mean, we all know a Luis Ortiz, or if we don't know one, a man like that, we should, because he is just an ordinary, regular American man who is trying to do what's right by his family, abide by the laws, and he steps into this opportunity, which is quite creative and quite daring and quite risky,
Yeah, it's a career that's very much up and down. I mean, it's the industry has changed. It's not, there's a lot of YouTube kind of stuff, and that's maybe not as lucrative as it was if, like, you were doing Leno every night or something. But it's also just, it's very fickle, you know. People, things can be interesting for a minute and then they disappear. And when you're dealing with political comedy, it's relevant for this week and then next week it's on to something else. So it's definitely a topsy-turvy career path. And not everybody would chase it. I mean, I've met, in the course of making this film, I've met a few other people who have a resemblance to Obama, not necessarily as striking as Lewis's, but and those folks have, you know, tried their hand at doing, getting into this industry, and a number of them have said, "Nah, I'm gonna not bother." it's a lot of work, and it's kind of weird. You know, in the film, there's a Bill Clinton character who's been doing this since 1992. You know, and he says it's kind of this vortex where it's this funny thing that he always says, as soon as you get into this world, you kind of start seeing everybody as a lookalike. You're like, oh, you look kind of like that person. And it's kind of this almost like parallel world kind of thing that happens. Lewis calls it the Twilight Zone a lot. And, one thing it would be interesting to note, too, is Lewis is a Puerto Rican guy. Puerto Rican guy from the Bronx, and I'm a white guy making a film about him who's impersonating the first black president. So I think there's a lot of interesting racial dynamics in the film, and in some ways, you know, some of the work that Lewis gets ends up being things that are negative. You know, you're telling jokes that are reflect poorly on Obama because that's sort of the crowd he's pandering to. So
yeah,
it's
and that
really
rap song, too, that he sings is like, oh, my gosh. I kept on thinking, are you really going to sing that? Ugh.
Yeah.
The lyrical content was really questionable there.
You know, I think there's kind of this, I know for Lewis, there's kind of this weight, this struggle of, like, he's sort of in a weird way an ambassador to the president's image. He's representing the president, even though it's not official in any way. But he feels this responsibility. But at the same time, he wants to take a job that'll, you know, pay his rent. So I think it's that constant. Trade-off, and over the course of the film and filming him, I think, you know, I watched him struggle with that many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my next director is in the studio, Ryan Murdock. I wanted to let our audience know that your film Bronx Obama is going to have quite a few screenings, which is excellent. It's having its West Coast premiere at the Roxy,
yeah.
Sunday the 8th, which is this Sunday, June 8th at 7 p.m., Wednesday,
yep.
Next Wednesday at June 11th at 9:15 p.m., and then at the Oakland School for the Arts on Saturday, June 14th at 5 p.m. So it's going to have a nice West Coast premiere run, and hopefully it'll be in some theaters. Are you going to be visiting us while your film is screening here?
Unfortunately, I can't make it out. I would love to. We have a lot going on with the film and right now, so we're not going to be there, but we're super excited to be at SF DocFest, and I'm really glad they liked the film and are bringing it to the San Francisco audience, because I think people will really have a lot to say about the film and hopefully enjoy it, have a good laugh, and also give them a lot to think about at the end of the day.
Certainly, certainly. And lastly, I wanted to ask you, don't worry, Kevin, I know you're in the studio. Hold on. I was wondering if you could tell us sort of what's going on with Lewis now. Is he still, working as the Bronx Obama? Is he still in the Bronx, or is he in Orlando with his daughter and his parents? What's he doing now?
Yeah, so he's still getting gigs as the Bronx Obama. He's available to book.
Give us his contact information. Some people listening might want to book him.
Well, everything, BronxObamaMovie.com is for the film, and then BronxObama.com is how you would reach Lewis for bookings and things like that.
Wow, how do you do a film after this one, right? I mean, like the book. Wow, like that's like writing a doing a film like this, like such a high mark, right?
Well, thank you. Hopefully we can step up from here. I feel like this one was a great first film, and working on a few ideas for the next one. So
nice, yeah. Yeah, you have a lot of great Barack Obama-isms, and one of them you write in the press kit is, or the film notes, one of the things you realize fairly quickly in this job, this is the president speaking, is that there is a character people see out there called Barack Obama. That's not you. Whether it is good or bad, it is not you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the opening quote in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, in making this film, I always thought, what would the president kind of be thinking about as he's watching the scene? Because he's such a thoughtful guy. He understands how modern politics work. I mean, and it's very true. Most people get a very small slice of who Obama is through whatever media they consume. And that's what a politician is these days, is kind of their image, which is not the same as the person who they are 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That is definitely true. Yeah, well, I really want to hear what happens when they have the screening at the White House, okay? And invite you and Luis Ortiz there. Yeah. That totally let me know. I have to have you all on again. All right, you take good care. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, good morning. Thanks, Kevin, for hanging in there. How are you?
No worries. I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Oh, your film, True Son, is just so gorgeous. Oh, my goodness. What a beautiful story. I hadn't even known about Michael, and I'm in the Bay Area. My sister-in-law lives in Stockton. It's like, wow, what a great story.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much.
Yeah, True Son. Wow. So tell us how you happened to meet Michael Tubbs, who was running, who had just graduated from Stanford and, a Stockton homeboy whose mother said, don't come back here, who decides to run for city council at 22, in the same year that President Obama was running for his second term, right?
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. The producers of the film knew Michael through undergrad at Stanford.
Uh-huh.
And when they heard he was running for office, they thought it would make for a good story and reached out to me. And, at first I was kind of hesitant because, it sounded a bit like a novelty campaign of some brash 21-year-old running for office. But as soon as I went out there and met Michael, I realized that this guy really was the real deal, could very well be the next Cory Booker or Barack Obama, and we'd have to chance to film it right from the very beginning. The first time I met him, it was like the 4th of July parade, and all the other candidates were in the parade, were in their cars going down like the main drag there in Stockton, and Michael and his like group of like teenage volunteers were just jogging around from side to side, high-fiving people and talking to them, and I just realized it was going to be a very different campaign.
Mhm. Yeah. And the way you make the film, which shows, your skill as a director, it's almost a how to you know, mobilize the grassroots and make a change in your city. Like, you don't have to take things, because when you think about, I mean, maybe people don't know that there are two Stocktons. There is a South Stockton, which is so weird. Like, the South is always the bad part, right?
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
I mean, the gated community. Yeah, it's kind of strange. Like, you know, well, but I guess maybe it sort of plays into maybe an invisible red state, blue state thing. You know, within a city, before we even had the term red state, blue state. I mean, that's a new thing that came about, you know, with President Obama's candidacy. You know, that whole thing around coloring, you know, the nation by party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you know, the statistics that you know that you share, and just sort of being right there. I mean, you're even in this house. Like how many camera people did you have? I mean, it's like you were almost like living with him. You have so many great shots.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, most of the film was just me and a sound person, and I was shooting and directing. And then there were a few critical moments when we had some additional cameras. But speaking to your point, you know, like the film, we definitely wanted it to be something that would inspire action by others. And our goal was to really try to show Stockton as a microcosm of problems that are facing cities all across the country. So we kind of emphasized the things that were the most universal or the most allegorical. You know, like the racial divides in this city exist all across the United States. The ones in Stockton are rooted in much older laws from, you know, kind of the Jim Crow era that still have vestiges today. But similar divides definitely exist in other places. And, you know, the story itself about what they were able to do, you know, so much about Michael is unique and special, but also he's definitely just drawn, like, lessons from other movements that he was able to apply there, and it's definitely something that can be done by other young people who want to get involved and want to be able to change their communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, you're... You are a Stanford grad yourself, and, you know, your MFA in documentary film is from there, and you have a BA in history from Yale, so it's like, oh, my goodness, you're well prepared to make this film. And you're based in San Francisco, and you have directed numerous award-winning shorts, including Dreams Awake, and that was the recipient of the 2010 Student Academy Award. Congratulations. And you've worked on productions for Disney, PBS, Facebook, and the New York Times. So I was just wondering, you know, sort of when you came into this particular story, just talk about the character, Michael Tubbs, and sort of, you know, how you're thinking around how you were going to tell the story, because, you know, Michael didn't really know how to run a campaign, and then they brought in someone, you know, after he had been sort of floundering, that knew how to do it, and the person didn't even believe in him initially, which is kind of funny that he said that on camera. and then Michael kind of fell out with him in the end because he got so tired, because, you know, and you show how, you know, someone who's running for office, you have to be able to make the ask. You can't just be an organizer. You have to get the money because, you know, particularly when you're running against an incumbent and who is as powerful as the person that he was running against, it's just so in suspense. And then I don't know. I wanted to, like, go online and see if he won, but I restrained myself.
Well done.
So I wanted to be pleasantly surprised, you know, like, at the campaign party, you know, when the results are coming in, which I think is really cool that we're talking the day after in our primary, you know, here in California, and, you know, we're wondering sort of, you know, who won, you know, these different offices. You know, are we going to still have the same governor, or did one of the Green Party people get it? I hope so. you know, which, you know, what happened with, you know, the measures, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's a lot of suspense there, which is fun, and I love that, you know, you're bringing in the voices of the grassroots folks, you know, the mothers who let, you know, who supervise their teenagers who are learning about how the democratic process works, you know, on the ground, you know, going out door to door, making those phone calls. I mean, this is really, really cool. But back to the question about Michael.
Totally, yeah. I mean, you know, any documentary film, you sort of start off with certain hypotheses, you know, about what the plot line is going to be. And, you know, some of those end up panning out and some don't, and new stories pop up. So a lot of it's about adapting while you're shooting and, like, just letting your intuition guide you. And then some things are actually only discovered in the edit. You're like, oh, wow, we actually have a really great arc here about this one character. So, you know, what was unique about this film was there's a long tradition of campaign documentaries, and most of them tend to focus on, often they don't have access to the candidate himself, so they focus more on the campaign manager, for instance. And some notable films were more about the opponent than they were about the candidate. But what we had access to with Michael, because he was so young and so new and so open, was really had access to his experience. So we knew the primary arc of the film was going to be following his own kind of journey, his own maturation, his own growing into becoming a candidate and ultimately a politician over the course of the film. So that was the main thing. But then there were a few definite surprises along the way that helped enrich the storytelling. I mean, we knew his mom was going to be a presence, but she ended up being one of the strongest characters in the film, definitely this kind of campaign mom who didn't want to be a campaign mom but ended up having to come on board. And then Michael's relationship with his campaign manager, who was kind of this experienced campaign manager who saw something in Michael and decided to take him under his wing. Those were the two biggest surprises in terms of plot. And then obviously we knew we had to build the suspense around the outcome itself as much as possible. Even people who knew the outcome in advance had moments of doubt while they were watching the cut. So I think that's a testament to our editor's skill.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's, yeah, but it, yeah, you really capture the suspense really well. And, yeah, it's, I mean, and I'm just thinking, wow, it just wouldn't have worked if he wouldn't have won. Would you have still, produced, you know, like, finished the film if he wouldn't have won?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great question. Yeah, I mean, there are famous campaign documentaries where the good guy or the main character loses. And, you know, then, you know, Michael said from the beginning that if he loses, he's just going to keep on trucking. He's going to stay in Stockton and try to achieve change in other ways. Mm-hmm. No matter what, we knew we'd have some kind of determined ending. And we also knew that no matter what the outcome was, he was touching the lives of these people around him on his campaign team, as well as the citizens of Stockton. So change was going to happen, regardless of whether Michael won or not. But at the end of the day, it was a bit of a gamble, and we were just very fortunate that it played out the way it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love watching him talk to the young people, the high schoolers, and he was sharing the poem by Tupac, The Rose That Grew from Concrete. And and he was saying, have you, and one of the kids like said he had seen a rose like growing from concrete, like really, like where? Yeah, and I love that poem as well. I teach it when I do a semester and focus on Tupac and his looking at the whole idea of whether we have a choice over how our lives end up or is it destiny, and all, mm-hmm. you know, sort of at the end of the class, like, oh, it's definitely a little bit of both. You know, we mm-hmm. do come with these certain circumstances, and we could look at Michael's life and the way you share with us, and he shares with the audience, you know, his mother was a teen mother, so you see why he's got a really young mom, and mm-hmm. how she... you know, he didn't have a relationship with his father. His father's in prison when he meets him, we hear. And his, you know, it's really lovely the way his mother says, you know, she kept him in the house, and we hear that story because she wanted him to be safe. And it reminded me of a play I just saw by Shanaka Hodge called Searching for Meserly, and the protagonist, his name is Watts, as in Lightbulb, and he's so afraid after Rodney King gets beaten, he doesn't go outside for 17 years. He stays in his house, and he reads Baldwin, he reads everything. And I just flashed on that when I thought about Michael. It's like, you know, his mother said it was like Christmas when he got books. And then to go to school, and his teachers, he says, I want to go to Stanford. And it's like, well, you're not going to get into Stanford. You think you're doing well here. You're going to be at the bottom mm-hmm. of the heap. And I'm like, wow, they're still saying that? Because he's 22. And you hear those kind of stories a long time ago, and he heard it when he was in high school, and I'm like, wow, not much has changed, even though things have changed, right?
Definitely, yeah, and I'd say, you know, structure versus agency was definitely a big theme in the film. And there was even Michael, in addition to running for city council, was simultaneously both had a job at the University of the Pacific and was teaching a high school sociology class in the morning.
Really?
And we filmed him. Yeah. So, I mean, the amount of stuff he was doing was unbelievable. But we filmed one of his lectures, which was about structure versus agency. And he was comparing another Tupac song, Changes, to that famous poem, God, is it Captain, My Captain? I can't remember the name of it, but it's about, there's a line in there where it's about being the captain of your own fate. So he led a conversation with the students about it. We didn't end up using it in the film because it was a little obvious and you kind of get the message in other ways. But, you know, Michael in some ways is one in a million, and in some ways is like, you know, anybody else can do this too. There's always that tension in his story.
Yeah.
I'd also say that Michael in general draws a lot of inspiration from hip-hop. Tupac was just a little bit of a taste of it, but he's really into J. Cole, and he kind of, all of his talks he peppers with a mix of hip-hop and Bible stories that somehow reach everyone who's in the room in one way or another.
And you showed him, you know, that he, you know, had a real strong sense of community, you know, from the church community. You shoot scenes in the church and you interview, you know, his pastor, and definitely, you know, even if you didn't, we could see that there was a strong spiritual core, you know, to the man he is. And I just love the scene where he's just, you know, dumbfounded that that these kids were going back and forth around how many people they had seen shot. You know, they were trying to one up each other around. Oh, I know four people that have been killed. You know, no, I know six people. And then you know, those statistics. And we hear the sirens a lot. You know, there are a lot of folks, you know, being killed in Stockton through handguns, and there are also a lot of people being killed in Stockton through police violence too on the community. And so, you know, sort of that particular, you know, what's going on in the community, and I don't know if it was all happening in the South, you know, in the poor part of Stockton versus, you know, the gated community. And I really liked his friend who came, I think, did he come back from New York to help with the campaign, who lived in the more affluent area in Stockton?
Yeah, Lang Lungtow. Yeah,
really, really, really nice. Real dedicated. I love hearing them sort of talk strategy. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the whole idea. I had known that Stockton was bankrupt. I'm like, really? Like Detroit bankrupt? Like, really?
Yeah. About Stockton's bankruptcy?
Yeah, I didn't know about that. I mean, you know, we hear of Detroit, but I knew about Richmond. I totally missed Stockton.
Oh yeah, Stockton. It was big headlines when it happened because up until that time, it was the largest municipality in the U.S. to go bankrupt. And it held that position until Detroit went bankrupt just a few months ago. But it made international headlines. There were Asian stories about it, lots of European stories about it. There was even versions of the film where we had some of those, or early edits of the film where we had some of that other news footage in there just to show how global it went. But we started filming 2 weeks after Stockton went bankrupt. And I think it also made big news because it seemed like there was a trend and that there was going to be a lot of California cities and possibly other cities around the U.S. that were going to go under as well. And when we started filming in Stockton, it was just like the low point emotionally for the city. Like people, you know, Stockton gets beaten up on a lot for its criminal records and high levels of poverty and stuff like that. And I think to have that bankruptcy happen just really took the wind out of people, and suddenly people wanted to leave and kind of give up on the city. So that was a low point, you know, emotionally for the city. And then we follow Michael and the campaign's effort to, like, kind of bring back hope and re-inspire people that something better can be done. As far as what generated the bankruptcy itself, I mean, that's a very long story, but depending on who you speak to, it's primarily about a big gamble that the city took on the housing market and kind of essentially trying to become the bedroom community for the Bay Area. And, you know, you could either see it as corruption spurred on by developers or by an overly optimist, or you could see it as an overly optimistic city council trying to do the best for its city. But definitely the city got a really bad deal, and when the housing market went bust, it just wiped out property values and left the city with a lot of debt that it couldn't pay, and that's what led to the bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your film, Kevin, is going to be screening at the Roxy and is having its West Coast premiere, so I presume that Michael might make an appearance? Because you're here in the Bay Area, right?
Definitely, yeah. I'll be at all three screenings. Michael is going to be at the first night, which is Saturday, June 7th. And I think other cast members are going to be there as well.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and the Roxy is kind of intimate, so that should be great. People should get their tickets early because Michael is famous. The director is too, but Michael's really famous.
Definitely.
Yeah. So the West Coast premiere again is at the Roxy in San Francisco with screenings this coming Saturday, June 7th at 7 p.m., and then next Wednesday, June 11th at 7 p.m., and at Oakland School for the Arts on June 14th, which is another Saturday, at 7:15 p.m., and that's really great that the director, Kevin Gordon, is going to be present at all the screenings, but if you want to catch Michael, you got to get to the first one, and then you probably want to go back and see it again. Are you going to have a theatrical run?
We're still working out distribution plans, but we definitely want as many people to see this film as possible. So stay tuned. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter to hear what's happening next.
Cool. And so I want you to talk for a minute before you go about the production team. But before you talk about all these wonderful filmmakers that you have accompanying you on this journey, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the wonderful music and the original score, because I asked for one of the songs, and I don't think you got the message because you didn't send it to me. But
I did not. Which song did you want?
It was the last one, and I even jotted down just in case because I didn't know
Letter
the name of it.
Letter to My Countrymen?
Yes. It's like, oh, my God, it's so beautiful. Yeah, I wanted to play that on the air. It is.
Oh, definitely. I wish, yeah, you definitely should, even after I get off the phone. It's Letter to My Countrymen by Brother Ali, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music that our additional editor, Emile Beaucaire, found from his own personal collection early on in the edit of the film, and we just fell in love with it. We were like, we have to have that. It is the most perfect piece of, like, politically conscious hip-hop that we could ever use. So I always, I get very happy when I hear that song. We had that song. We also had another song called Port City Hero, which is actually by a young Stockton rapper, and we really wanted to include some local talents in the film. His name's Carlos Bryant, and that's also a fantastic piece of music. And the rest of the score was by Jared Banta, who's an L.A.-based composer, and really helped take the film to another level with some pieces that really emphasize what was going on in at different moments in the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, you notice it. Sometimes one doesn't notice the score in a movie, but I noticed your music. you gave it. You didn't talk. You didn't have the characters talking over it, so we were able to actually really like just be in it, and it was almost like they were characters within themselves, these various pieces, which is really nice, particularly when you have such a wonderful message, in the piece that complements what's going on, in the scene actually, in the scene itself. I asked you to talk about the other filmmakers, but I just wanted to mention really quickly, and you could, talk about it yourself, about all these celebrities that pop up, and say it. I was like, oh, my God, this is so cool.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty well known at this point that Oprah backed Michael's campaign. he's only the third candidate she's ever donated to, the first two being Cory Booker and Barack Obama. And then the second celebrity, MC Hammer, makes an appearance in the film. It was funny when we were editing because one of the challenges was to not make this seem totally absurd, like how on earth are both of these people in this film and backing Michael? And the editorial solution was to put the two events as close together as possible. In fact, almost immediately following each other. So it was just one moment of, oh, my God, there's celebrities getting on board. Because if they were ever spread apart too far, the viewer was like, what? There's another one? Again, one of those examples of Michael's amazing ability to inspire and attract interest from other people.
And I just thought it was so this synchronicity of you know, he didn't ask MC Hammer or Minister Hammer for he didn't ask him for what he, you know, he didn't ask him, he didn't give a price for what he needed, like he was lower, like he should have told him, I need this, because that might have been the question, but he went under that, and MC Hammer gave him what he needed. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, that he gave exactly what he needed. Because, you know, we're wondering, like, how are you going to get the money to produce your brochures? You need, I don't know, $100,000, I think is what they needed to make.
That's right.
Yeah, and he, I mean, you know, it was like it was trickling in, particularly with $5 here and $10 there. And, of course, you know, tens dollars here and there do add up, but he didn't have a lot of time.
Yeah, that's true. Michael was definitely a reluctant fundraiser and never really learned, and then only over the course of the film really learned to ask. But, yeah, with MC Hammer, he never gave him an exact number. But what Hammer gave was exactly what they needed at that stage in the campaign. And there was just a lot of synchronicity and things like that happening throughout what was a very charmed campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now tell us about these other folks that help you make this beautiful film.
Sure, yeah. It was a really interesting team because all of us were filmmakers who'd worked on other people's feature-length projects and produced their own short films or worked on TV series. But for all of us, this was our first feature-length film. So the producers, John V. and Kedike Sriram, were first-time producers. I was a first-time director. Our editor, Laura Green, had assistant edited many films, but this was also her first project. Emile Beaucaire, the other editor, and then a whole host of people who came along with me as sound and second camera while we were in Stockton. We were all doing this for the first time and figuring out things as we went, and there was kind of this interesting parallel between our own experiences and the campaign. While we were filming, we were seeing them making mistakes and figuring things out. We simultaneously were making mistakes and figuring things out. And then it all repeated itself again in the edit, which was, you know, took us over a year. And it was funny because you have those moments in every edit where you're like, how are we going to do this? You're just stuck. You're like, oh, my God, we cannot do this. But we actually drew inspiration from the campaign at those moments. They can do it. We can do it. And we would just power through.
Right. Yeah. But True Son is definitely one of those wonderful films that's going to be around. It's going to be one of those films that people pull off the shelf often. When it's available that way for purchase. But in the meantime, folks can, you know, get to the theater on Saturday, this coming Saturday, June 7th, 7 p.m., for the first screening of the West Coast premiere at the 13th Annual San Francisco Documentary Film Festival. So congratulations on this great film. And, yeah, send me some music, and I can play it on Friday on my next show and let people know that they can don't want to miss your screening on Saturday because I have a show on Friday. So there's still time to get it on the air. And then
that
the following week,
great.
I can play it again, play some of the other ones you mentioned.
Play
you know,
it,
by,
spread the word. Tell Brother Ali I want to meet him.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. Congratulations. Looking forward to you know, seeing some of your other films. Do you have anything, any ideas you're working on?
Yeah, there's a few projects that I'm vetting right now. And I just finished my first music video, which will be released in the next few weeks, which is for musician McCleet, She's an Ethiopian American singer-songwriter.
She's been on my show like lots of times. Yeah, we are Make League groupies here. Wow. So where is it going to be released at, the music video?
We're basically pitching it to various music video blogs. I think that's ultimately going to be the determinant. But you can just watch on her website. It'll be announced soon enough.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, I'll just play something from Make League. Yeah, from A Day Like Today. I'll play Call.
Sounds good.
Wow. You take good care. Again, it's great talking to you. And since you're in the Bay Area, I'm sure our paths will cross one time in the near future.
That sounds great. Have a good day.
You too. Peace and blessings.
Heavy, sweet orange, made the branch bow low, 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 low. Well, once a Maya, a thumb on high, when it is ready for hungry hands. It kept upon you. A little bell, its halo grows and power swells. You are seduced by its call. Oh yeah, its call. When the dreamer, a warm lover, like the orange, well she was dressed in, well she dressed in color. When the sparrow, a warm lover, she sang a note, sing her note, sing her note into the ether. She kissed upon you a little bell. A halo rose, power swells. You are seduced by her call. Oh yeah, her call. Now the time for standing in the middle of the midnight hour, alone. Well, it have gone no more, staring at the stars no more, no more, no more. Now the time for building has come, and love will build itself a house. It will sway in the wind, but it will not fall till the time for falling has come.
With an interview with director Chris Mason Johnson, whose film Test opens on June 6th in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Sebastopol. And his film is a visually stunning, beautifully choreographed, and powerfully moving story set in the San Francisco modern dance scene of 1985 in the early years of the AIDS epidemic, right before the first HIV test is announced. The film runs about 89 minutes, and it's in English. Really, really wonderful film. The test follows Frankie, actor Scott Marlowe's debut, actually, in the film. And Frankie is a young dancer confronting the challenge of being an understudy in a modern dance company where he's taught to dance like a man. Frankie embarks on a budding relationship with Hunky Todd, who's portrayed by Matthew Rich, a veteran dancer in the same company and the bad boy to Frankie's naivete. As Frankie and Todd's relationship deepens, they navigate a world of risk, the early years of the AIDS epidemic, but also a world of hope, humor, visual beauty, and musical relief. The captivating dance sequences, which are excellently choreographed, were specifically choreographed for the film by acclaimed U.S. choreographer Sidra Bell. And the film soundtrack includes work by 80s icons Jimmy Somerville, Bronski Beat, Klaus Nomi, Romeo Void, Laurie Anderson, Martha and the Muffins, Cocktail Twins, or the Chatel Cocktail Twins, and Sylvester. And this film screened, test screened at numerous film festivals around the globe, including Frameline 37, which was just last year, Outfest, and the Berlin International Film Festival. And director Chris Mason Johnson began his career as a dancer in ballet and modern companies throughout the U.S. and Europe, including the Frankfurt Ballet and the White Oak Dance Project with Mikhail Baryshnikov. Since his transition to film, he has worked as head of development at Open City Films, as script editor and analyst for Miramax, Dimension, Disney, ABC Family, and Fine Line, and has taught dance at UCLA as well as screenwriting and film production production at Amherst College. In 2009, Chris co-wrote, directed, and produced his first feature, The New 20. He's received grants from a lot of places, and now we're going to play this wonderful interview with him. And the film, I highly recommend the film. It is simply marvelous. And again, it's one of those films that is visually beautiful and shows, you know, San Francisco as a really a beautiful destination, and highlights, you know, some of the many people that live there and call the place home. So, looking for the film. And I'm not seeing it right now. Let's see. Oh, here it is. Wanted to tell you that, wow, your film, The Test, has such suspense.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I just love the cinematography. It's just so beautiful. I grew up in San Francisco, so it's just lovely seeing all those spots and going back to that period of time when the public was really afraid of HIV and AIDS disease. And but I hadn't, I didn't know, you know, about, you know, sort of the media around that, and it sort of reminds me of the South, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but only as, you know, anti-gay.
Scapegoating and it was just a terrible moment historically, yeah.
So this is your second feature, right?
It's my second, yeah. The first is The New 20, which was released in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Takes a long time to get things made in the independent world.
Mm-hmm. Is the subject matter quite different between the two?
Yeah, the New 20 is about a group of friends turning 30, sort of in the investment banking world in New York, and it's an ensemble drama about friendship, and some of the characters are gay and some of them are straight. They're mixed in, sort of multi-ethnic and gay and straight. And that kind of reflected my experience at Amherst College, graduating and moving to New York with friends there. I went to college after I danced professionally,
mm-hmm.
so I was a little older than the other kids at college, and so that movie was about that. And then this one, yeah, it's about the dance, obviously.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, an ensemble, certainly, between, you know, I mean, dancers. I mean, when we look at them on stage, it's as if they're a family. And I'm certain there's a certain kind of sort of relationship that develops between the cast for it to work, right?
Yes, and that was really a great experience on this movie because these dancers really liked each other,
mm-hmm.
and the choreographer, Sidra Bell, who's New York-based, I don't know if you looked her up yet,
mm-hmm.
She's very talented, and they liked each other, they hit it off, and you can sort of feel that on screen, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about sort of the genesis of this particular piece and how you pulled together all these great dancers, and it's just beautiful, and also, you know, the score is an original score. The music is definitely, you can, sometimes you don't notice the music, but I guess in a film with dancers you actually do. I mean, we even hear, you know, what's going on in The Walkman, which is nice. It's a different kind of music, and the disco scene and all that. It's kind of cool.
Right. The composer, Carrie Torgerson, he worked really closely in a different, like usually a composer makes the music after the film is finished and he watches it and he composes a score.
Mm-hmm.
But because we just had 2 weeks to make all the dancing in it, so we had to have the music to choreograph to it.
Right.
So it was almost more like the theater, you know, we were all working together to make it, you know, right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your sort of bigger question about why I did this, or
mm-hmm,
or I had been working on like a more commercial project that was bigger and that sort of got stalled, as a lot of them do, for funding, and I just sort of said, you know, I want to write something very personal that I can make,
you know, that I can shoot here where I live in San Francisco. And then because I'd been in the dance world, I was in a bunch of ballet companies and, you know, I danced with Baryshnikov and, like, major companies. So I had connections into the dance world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started meeting with dancers and whose dancing I liked and seeing who had sort of an instinct for acting, you know. And I found my lead guy, Scott, and who's local. And then we workshopped for, like, 6 months, you know, developing scenes together, and I was teaching him how to act, and so it was a really tight collaboration with him.
Mhm. Yeah. I like Matthew is also Matthew Rich.
Rich, yeah.
Yeah, he's so, like,
sexy.
Bad boy. Yeah, that too.
And yeah, he's a real bad boy.
Yeah, and then the contrast physically between he and Scott, you know, Scott's, you know, sort of a light brown, ashy brown hair, freckles, and then Matthew's darker, and it's also Matthew, his character, Todd, seems to, he's real risk-taking, sort of on the edge, takes Frankie, Scott's character, into these places that he doesn't necessarily venture,
because
Scott's character seems to be like a good boy.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted those opposites in character, but also, as you say, in typology and
mm-hmm.
their looks, because that's like a pet peeve of mine when you have these guys who all look the same, and it's just I can't keep them apart. I can't keep the characters separated, and you're just like missing out on like some the whole opposites attract dynamic, you know,
mm-hmm.
in visually and. In terms of chemistry. Mm-hmm. So Matt Risch is like a Broadway dancer and an actor, and then everybody else is dancers who just do their first acting work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I noticed that there are a whole lot of levels of imagery going on with regards to meaning, like symbols. I'm thinking about, you know, the bird and the mouse or the rat, and then
the mouse, yeah.
Yeah, and I know that Brillo trick. It does work.
Oh, yeah, totally. I know it, too. Yeah,
mm-hmm, yeah. And then the beautiful old Victorians, you know, the flats, you know, that you're filming in, those are really lovely. I'm just wondering, and then the actual dance piece itself that's at the Kyle Theater, is it McManus? And I'm just wondering about the story, you know, Frankie's character in the actual dance piece and his gestures and how at the rehearsal it's like, you know, you got to dance like a man even if you sleep with men. And I thought that was like, okay, do they really say things like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
Really?
No.
Really?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the word I use, which most people don't know, and it's a weird word, is effeminophobia.
Mm.
Which is not the same as homophobia because it's about being against sort of sissies,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's not so much who you fuck, you know, pardon my French, as it is just whether you act like a man.
Mm.
And I think, you know, that's pretty strong in our culture. You know, I think obviously it overlaps with homophobia because a lot of gay men might be quote-unquote effeminate,
mm-hmm.
but it's not exactly the same thing, you know. It's kind of the flip side of misogyny.
Mm.
It's like, why is it bad to be effeminate? Well, it's bad to be effeminate because it's bad to be a woman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the imagery, I mean, there was a lot, well, just sort of picking apart some of that. The thing with the mouse was mm-hmm. just... you know, you can control how well you dance, and that's, like, typical dramas deal with things you can control, and they're, like, tests of character. But the thing with an HIV test is you can control it. It's chance. You know, so the mouse was sort of about that, you know, one mouse dies in a glue trap and another mouse survives in a cage with a treadmill and he's happy,
mm-hmm.
and it's just kind of random, And Frankie's just this very, very small character in a bigger story, just small, person who just happens to survive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the imagery in the dance that you mentioned,
we really wanted,
like most movies, that like this is not a movie about getting sick or being sick. It's a movie about being afraid of disease, of getting sick, right?
Right.
About fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted the body to be in it in an erotic way. And most AIDS movies are more deathbed movies where people are sick and there's no sexiness in it for obvious reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted the movie to be sexy and erotic, but at the same time to have this sort of creepy element. And Sidra Bell, the choreographer, and I worked on that in the dance. So there's all these weird gestures that we lifted from some paintings. And sort of wove in so that there's this kind of ominous feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. I like the suspense. and then you know, with the name of the test, I kept on wondering, like, well, when is somebody going to take the test that we hear about? There's a test for it. And what's going to be the result? Because we got all these folks and quite a few of them are having unprotected sex, and some of them are actually sleeping with men and women. It's like, really? Like,
right.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have women, you know, in the film that, you know what's going on with regards to HIV and AIDS in the gay world, because so many of the people they dance with, you know, are gay men, and the question, are you afraid? I just thought that was just a great sort of speaking what we're thinking and feeling as we, you know, watch the film unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And see what's going on, you know, with the
right.
Yeah.
So much of it is about people not speaking, like the lead character doesn't talk about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you're right, when she asks him there, it's like it's making verbal this thing, there's nothing else in his mind but that, but no one's talking about it. So when
mm-hmm.
someone actually mentions it, it's kind of frightening and startling.
Mhm. Yeah. And then you know, I think Scott's Frankie, he really embodies sort of kind of a wonderland, kind of not quite present,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of sensibility. He doesn't
yeah.
seem to be quite in the world.
Right.
And then when he takes Valium, it's like, oh, he is really not. Like,
right. That's what he's trying to do, exactly. No,
mm-hmm.
you're right. He's trying to numb, and he's trying to retreat from the world, and that's what the whole Walkman is about. It's like, you know, ostrich with head in sand kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Yes. mm-hmm.
So, he wants to pretend it isn't happening, and he wants it to go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about the your choreographer and that particular story. So is it this particular piece? Because I thought maybe it might have been something classical, you know, the actual piece. So I looked it up to see if it was, because I thought I recognized the name McManus, but it's not spelled quite the same.
No,
way.
That was just a guy, a friend of mine I danced with in the Frankfurt Ballet, and I just took his name as just sort of for fun. No, the company is totally fictional, yeah.
Oh, pretty cool, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice. And I was, toward the end, you have Scott's character, Frankie, going to a bookstore. And I thought you were going to show us what the book's name was.
Right.
But you don't.
You were missing that.
Yeah. And so I was trying
it's
to jot down.
So yeah, no. When you show the title of a book, I had that debate. Then audiences expect it to come back later in some way.
Oh.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he was just book boy. He was just retreating into books and being
mm-hmm.
intellectual. He's more intellectual than the other character, yeah.
Yeah, I love when he said Walt as in Walt Whitman, and the other guy says Walt Disney. I'm like, that's heck of cute.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
unusual to know who Walt Whitman is at
mm-hmm.
that age. Yeah.
Right, and then when the taxi driver says, why are you going here? Like,
nothing,
you know,
down here but a bunch of human garbage, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, wow. Man.
Now, that was something a taxi driver actually said to me once.
Really?
Yeah, in New York when I took a taxi down to Christopher Street.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what are you doing down here? Because I was so young and I must have looked like I was 12, you know, and he was trying to protect me. But it was just, you know, nothing down here but a bunch of human garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty tough. I mean, that goes back to the South thing, you know, that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You just get that all around you. Thank God it's starting to disappear a little bit. But it's such a powerful force when you're surrounded by those messages. And I think kids growing up in like a post-gay marriage, you know, post-Obama as president kind of world, hopefully, you know, they don't get as much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very powerful force on informing your sense of self, you know. And that's, I think, also why in the early AIDS epidemic, for a lot of gay men, even though they might have known better intellectually,
mm-hmm.
it felt like a punishment, you know. It felt like God's punishment because they'd been internalizing all these messages all their life that they were less than and they were worthless and they were, you know, whatever. So it was a very powerful moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just looking over some of the files for your team. Oh, my mm-hmm. God. You've got like a... You must have had a lot of money.
No money. We did this so cheaply.
Hmm, really?
Super cheap.
Hmm. Yeah, is that a formula you're going to market?
What's that?
How you can do a film of this you know, craft, you know, really wonderful craft on a real shoestring. I mean, that's something you might want to share.
Yeah, no, it was just $200,000 was the whole budget.
Oh, wow.
Everything, which is, you know, micro-budget. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that. You say it's something you might want to share. I think you're right because one of the things, you know, it happened with my first movie, too, which was also really low-budget. I make these movies that are really well-crafted and kind of look expensive,
mm-hmm.
and people expect these little down-and-dirty indies to look down and dirty. So I kind of, sometimes I think it, like, falls between the cracks because it doesn't have the marketing budget of a big movie, but it kind of looks like it was expensive. So people don't always know what to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'd rather have a beautiful-looking movie.
Oh, yeah, it's really gorgeous. I was looking at sort of the, you know, the diversity of your team,
mm-hmm.
the creative team, Sidra Bell, and everyone seems to be so well-educated. Yeah.
That's the magic of bios, right? No, she's great. I loved working with her, and we want to work together again.
Mm-hmm.
She has a real cinematic eye. Yeah, she did a great job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just love watching the dancers, you know, stretch and work out and, you know, rehearse. And this is amazing, you know, with the protagonist, how he was an extra. He might not have actually gone on.
Right.
So that was kind of cool, too. And that also sort of plays into what you were talking about with the chance and not being able to control certain things, like the results of a test.
Right.
Yeah, so that Frankie was an understudy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're right. He's in this very powerless position in a number of ways, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to know his backstory because I'm wondering, like, how can you afford to live where you live?
Oh, well, gosh, in that year with those mice and the roommate, I think he probably could have.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, because the dance companies, you know, they'll pay you like a salary for 30 weeks out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other 20 weeks you make unemployment.
Oh, right, okay.
So you're always have some income. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And, you know, things were cheaper.
Mhm. Yeah. So, how do you like it? You know, making films, not being, you know, in the work, you know, as a dancer anymore. How do you like that shift? Do you miss the stage, you know, as a dancer?
I do miss performing. Yeah. I think the biggest difference is when I was dancing, you know, we were always rehearsing and performing, and you were always in production, you know.
Mm-hmm.
With film, I love being in production. I love shooting. I love editing. But you do it, you know, it's like 5 weeks every 3 years, you know, of production and then 6 months of editing every 3 years. So I love it, but it's not as much, you know, there's not as much work as there was in the theater just because things move so slowly in the film world.
Mm-hmm.
Things move more quickly in TV, so I'd like to move a bit into TV.
Yeah, and I noticed that when your film opens, it's also available on demand, so people can see it in a couple of different ways.
Yeah, please mention that. Amazon and iTunes. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the new 20 also available?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. You can watch it.
Okay.
And it's Netflix as a DVD. It doesn't stream, but it streams on. Do you know that website, gowatchit.com?
No, I don't. That sounds nice.
Yeah, it's G-O-W-A-T-C-H-I-T, go watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, like, type in a movie title, and it'll tell you where it's available. So it's very useful.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Wow. Yeah. And do you have another work in the hopper presently?
I do. I'm getting ready to start shooting something in Berlin, and I'm also developing something for TV.
Okay.
Early stages of both, but I'm eager to taking things to festivals, like I've been doing test for about a year now with festivals, and now it's getting released. That's kind of a full-time marketing job. So yeah, I'm really eager to get creative again.
Right, yeah. Well, it's just really, really wonderful. It's a beautiful film. Congratulations. And wow, 200,000. Oh, my goodness.
Thanks, Wanda.
Let me know when you're going to be having your workshop. I got people I can send.
Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind.
All right. Thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the director of... Yes. And again, the film is opening theatrically here in the San Francisco Bay Area on June 6th, if I'm remembering my notes correctly. I just wanted to mention that First Friday is going to be screening next week, next Saturday, at the Oakland School for the Arts, and then next Sunday at the Roxy, Oakland School for the Arts at 12:30, and at the Roxy at 2:30 that Sunday. And I was looking for my notes, but I believe that the young man who was killed, his birthday is in June, and I wasn't certain if his birthday is June 14th or not, but I know his birthday is this month, and we want to pour an ashe for him, and really happy that this film is coming out, and that the San Francisco Indie 13th Annual Doc Fest is going to be screening this rough cut, which is very lovely, and everyone's going to really enjoy it, and really happy that we were able to talk to so many great directors this morning on the show. Ryan Murdoch about Bronx Obama, and Kevin Gordon about True Son, and again, Chris Mason Johnson about Test. All righty, so we're going to close out with another song, and we're going to play The Pyramids, What the World Needs Now.
What the world needs now is grace, love, peace, mercy, and healing. Said what the world needs now grace, peace, mercy, love, we need healing. We need grace, we need mercy, we need peace, peace, we need it.